Friday, everybody. Dennis Prager here, and thank you for being with me. Sean, it is time for our global warming update theme. Yes, everybody. It's almost a daily feature now on the Dennis Prager Show. More and more scientists are coming out and saying that, whoa, we may have a lot of agenda-driven claims rather than real science going on here with the man-made global warming catastrophe that we are told about. Writing a deeply effective book against the global warming hysteria, my guest is Christopher Horner, and he is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. His book, part of a terrific series. You should get every one of them. They're in paperback. This is really one of the most important series of books of the last decade. This is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming, and in parentheses, and environmentalism. Christopher Horner, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Thank you, Dennis, very much.
Did you ever get introduced with the hot, hot, hot theme?
I think I may have. There's no shortage of mockery.
There is. That is exactly the point. Many years ago, and I'm certainly not comparing the two in any means, but I realized people used to ask me, do you ever get calls from Holocaust deniers? And I said, yeah, every so often. I said, well, and they say, well, how do you deal with them? And I said, the only way really is through mockery. The moment you just sit there and only say, well, you know, we have evidence that there were gas chambers, you give that person credence. And while this is not at all in the same moral world, a little mockery is very helpful because it needs to be. And first of all, what predisposed you to writing this book?
Well, I stumbled onto the issue in 1997 through means that surprised a lot of people because it doesn't this angle of the Kyoto industry, global warming industry, doesn't make the press very often, but. I was innocently practicing law in Washington for a Texas-based law firm, and a client of the firm named Enron asked me to be director of federal government relations, essentially a no-interview job offer. The firm made it quite clear I was to take it. They liked planting people in firms, in clients, and I did. And on my second day, I learned my number one priority was to ensure there was a treaty capping carbon dioxide emissions in the name of catastrophic man-made global warming, because Enron had gone about purchasing the world's largest windmill company, a half share in the world's largest solar panel company, with Amoco, now BP. The windmills are owned by now responsible GE, who also picked up Enron's lobbying agenda. They set up a trading floor so they could play bookie on both ends to selling carbon dioxide credits, which is what would be required under Kyoto-style rationing schemes. And they had the world's second largest gas pipeline network outside of Gazprom, which would be very, very valuable once coal was regulated out of business. That's just one way a business in the U.S. gets into finding responsibility, a virtue. That is, they decide that they can create some schemes to profit from an energy-scarce world, and then they go about pushing said agenda. So that's how I fell into it, working on the issue for 10 years, representing politicians from Senator Jim Inhofe to a couple of members of Congress to scientists before the Supreme Court last year. This issue is still pending before the Supremes. This is what I do, and I subjected myself to Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation early last year, and it was quite clear that he was taking remarkable liberties, believe it or not, with the science, the history, and the politics of this, revising his own role, his own administration's actions, doing the easy thing to recast, stating obviously disprovable statements like George Bush is mean because he won't sign the Kyoto Protocol, when in fact the Clinton-Gore administration signed it, and he knows this. Bush changed policies from Clinton Gore. No, he didn't. He said exactly the same thing Al Gore's on record saying. I'm not going to submit this to the Senate. He doesn't have to, as a matter of the Constitution, by the way, unless developing countries jump on. It's exactly what Al Gore was quoted on CNN saying on December 12, 1997, when the U.S. agreed to it. So he gave a PowerPoint. It was pretty obvious where this was going. A senator named John McCain, who I otherwise admired quite a bit, in fact, he's why I came to Washington some time ago to work for him. I never did. Is going to lead a race to the bottom in the Republican primaries on this issue, where politicians will, at best, submissively wet the carpet and then nod in agreement and try to me-too you on environment issues, because Republicans particularly are very uncomfortable with this. So a long way of saying there was a perfect storm brewing on an issue that is of remarkable stupidity and cynicism in trying to capture on some of our best emotions, some of our worst emotions, our gullibility, corporate greed, and political need to say, I'm here to save you. So I thought it was time to engage.
Did you happen to notice the Sports Illustrated this week? It's got a cover of a pitcher standing in knee-deep water, and it's titled "Going, Going Green as Global Warming Changes the Planet." Not that anybody can actually name anything changed. It is changing the sports world to counter the looming environmental crisis. Surprising and innovative ideas are already helping sports adapt.
I saw that the mainstream media
speak of it as a given, as the sun rising in the east.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know this because we start with the answer. The human did it. I mean, that's been the answer for 30 years. We had a respite of about 400 years where we stopped blaming man for the weather. Before that, the Germans kept very meticulous records, speaking of the Holocaust, and I have them and submitted them in my final manuscript, of the witch burnings they undertook region by region to correct the weather, because it was obvious the witches were responsible for the global cooling that was going on during the Dark Ages and the subsequent crop failure. It's been a long-standing presumption of ours that, you know, shake some chicken feet and say man did it, but in fact, we just re-delved into this in about the 1970s. And now people like sports, you know, or entities like Sports Illustrated jump on with Leonardo DiCaprio and the documentarians Keanu Reeves and Alanis Morissette with a cameo by Selma Hayek talking about the Vostok ice core samples, I presume. Very moving pictorials, generally, with absolutely no substantive underpinnings, and seizing once again on emotions, stating hypotheses, which used to
All
be
right.
scientific.
Are you you prepared to answer those who believe in man-made global warming?
Sure. Sure.
Folks, here's your chance. All of you who believe that it is taking place, who have seen the Al Gore documentary, who have read about it, who believe that the experts who are telling us about this are right, the experts who were against it are wrong, here's your chance. We do this often on the program, and I want to give you all the opportunity in the world to bring your challenges from the polar bear to the Antarctic. 1-8-PRAGER-776, 1-8-PRAGER-776. While people are calling in, and then I'll pose the challenges that come to my mind, though you and I happen to agree, I have a larger question here that fascinates me, and I'd love to get your thought on it. Why is it that the average liberal is far more likely to fear global warming than the average conservative?
Because the proposed response is a wish list of long-held policy objectives. It's that simple. There's no need to look any further. We accept it as dogma. If you happen to share the liberal, what we call liberal in America philosophy, which is massive governmental intervention in the economy is absolutely necessary, wealth is the disease, not the cure, and redistribution is of utmost priority, and we need energy scarcity because man does horrible things with energy. He grows economically. Essentially, what is proposed in response to catastrophic man-made global cooling in the 70s and catastrophic man-made global warming now, both of which the science has settled, it wasn't either time, it isn't now, is the same thing. And it's actually the same people proposing it. So not only is the agenda a wish list, but the people proposing it are your doppelgangers. I mean, this didn't originate from people who believe in open markets, free trade, and limited government. But those people are more likely to be skeptical for, you know, sort of opposite reasons.
I agree with regard to the elites. And for policymakers, politicians, people who are preoccupied with public policy. But the average individual who is conservative and the average individual, the folks, you know, managing families, going to work, coming back home, you will still find far more people who define themselves as liberal who believe this. Teachers, for example. Teachers are showing Al Gore's film, but they would never show a counter film.
Right.
Now teachers tend leftward. That's true. But it is. Is it because they want more government intervention? There's got to be more, I think.
Well, if I say in 10 seconds briefly, there's a very strong desire, particularly on that side of the aisle, to believe man is agent of doom. And this satisfies that like nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, interesting thesis. All right, we're going to take all the challenges possible. Anything. Folks, this is your chance. Even if you're not sure, if you're in the middle, you're on the fence. Christopher Horner, he is the writer of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. We come back in a moment. This is Dennis Prager. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. I have the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. That series is a superb series. I think I've had the authors of each one of them on, and they're superb. They are very worth your while reading, studying, even memorizing to the best of your ability. Christopher Horner is his name. And let me just pose some quickies and then go to all challenges that any of you have or just questions or you're curious about global warming. Let's take the best-known examples here and let me just understand your positions. Number one, do you believe that the globe is warming?
You tell me your baseline and I'll tell you my answer. If you mean since the end of the Little Ice Age in the mid-late 19th century, which is generally the framework in which we speak, yes, it has warmed 0.6 of a degree Celsius.
Which is how much Fahrenheit?
That's Celsius.
I say, how much is that in Fahrenheit?
It's about a degree.
About 1 degree in the last more than 100 years.
You're right, which is obviously not catastrophic, not unprecedented. It warmed faster than it has recently since the 70s in the 1930s, and faster. So more and faster, and the bears did just fine, thank you.
Why was there a global freezing scare in the 70s?
Because we start with the answer. We know that whatever's happening must continue on, and that it's man's fault. So we had a almost four-decade-long cooling from the 1940s to the late 1970s. And since we knew man was at fault, we spent an awful lot of money putting up the satellites, measuring the atmosphere temperature, because this is an atmospheric theory, not the surface theory, even though you hear about surface temperatures, which are not all that relevant. And the atmospheric satellites, the radio, these microwave sounding instruments, tell us that it's not warming or cooling up in the atmosphere appreciably either way.
What about the greenhouse gases being kept in?
Being what?
Hello?
Being what?
Hello? Did I lose you?
No.
I'm sorry, but the carbon emissions.
What about them?
Yeah, what I want your position on this problem of man-made carbon emissions being kept in or keeping in the heat.
Well, I can't say the science has settled on that, and I can't start with the presumption that it's a problem, because we know that emissions increase radically, more radically, man-made emissions, more radically than we've ever seen in history, from, let's say, September 1st, 1939 through the 1970s, and it cooled. They continued increasing at a very rapid rate, a linear rate, half as fast as the computer models tell us, but still, you know, 0.5% a year, and it started warming. So obviously greenhouse gas concentrations do not dictate temperature. Al Gore's own movie shows this. The data he cites show it. They were published in June, Science Magazine, 2006. And we know that CO2 temperature, CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere tend to increase after warmings. You can get lucky, that is statistically, and start at the 1970s and claim, well, they went up, temperature went up, ergo they caused temperature to go up. And I'll simply point out that cell phone use went up, temperature went up, ergo cell phone use caused temperature to go up. Correlation isn't causation. There's research from Richard Lindzen and others showing about the iris effect. There's a venting at the equator. We can't start with the presumption that CO2 concentrations are a problem. And by the way, man doesn't dictate concentrations. They go up, they go down. Al Gore's movie shows this too.
They go up, they go down on their own?
Of course they do. Al Gore shows two charts, and he intimates, but doesn't dare say, for example, that over 650,000 years, which happens to be the proxy data he's showing, temperatures went up four times warmer than they are now, by the way. He doesn't focus on that. And they went down, and he shows a chart of recreations of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. So temperatures went up, concentrations went up. Unfortunately, if he chose to superimpose the charts, which he did not for a very good reason from his perspective, you would see that, again, the cause-effect relationship's not there. But they go up, they go down, because Mother Nature is a very complex thing. The climate is very complex, which is why we spend $5 billion with a B in U.S. taxpayer dollars alone trying to understand it. It's the same amount of money we send to the National Cancer Institutes every year, and I would suggest that that science is not settled either, a cure for cancer. It goes up, it goes down. The odd thing, Dennis, is the treaty we have signed, again, very bad reporting, November 12, 1998. We signed the Kyoto Protocol. Enough of this Bush should sign it business. It purports to cap CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, not man's emissions, but CO2 concentrations. And everybody knows they've been much, much higher in the past, including when it was cooler, by the way. And they've been much lower. They go up, they go down. That's up to Mother Nature. That's why we spend $5 billion a year.
Let's take some calls here, and we begin with Eric. Eric in Los Angeles. You're on with Christopher Horner and Dennis Prager.
Hi, Christopher. You seem very well informed about this, but I'm just curious. The National Academy of Sciences doesn't seem to take the same attitude about this that you do. Have you heard of the National Academy?
Do you have a question? A serious question.
Have you heard of the National Academy?
Oh, come on, come on. Eric, he's right. Don't ask a stupid question. Ask your real question. You think he's an idiot?
I don't know.
Everybody listening has heard of the National Academy. My 12-year-old has heard of them.
Okay, we was established by Abraham Lincoln to give the best possible scientific advice to the American Congress and people. Its advice is that we do have something to worry about. Why does he feel that the National Academy is wrong about this?
Actually, that's a very good point, or I know what you're trying to articulate, and that's the following, or maybe trying to avoid articulating, and that is the National Academies of various countries got together and said...
The National Academy has made numerous reports on this issue, including
like
one with your friend.
Okay, all right. Eric, let him finish. I'm keeping you on, Eric.
Thank you.
What the National Academies have said of 11 countries was that we know enough that cost-effective measures are in order. That's what they said. If you dispute it, then I'll ask you if you've ever heard of the National Academies. I know you won't, because that's what they said. So I'm asking anybody to please come forth with a cost-effective proposal. So far, the only thing on the table is the Kyoto Protocol, which, according to the Clinton administration, would cost 4% of GDP, which is five times the cost of the Iraq War every year, for an undetectable delay for 6 years of 7/100ths of 1 degree Celsius 50 years down the road. In other words, an awful lot of money for no detectable impact doesn't fall under the rubric of cost-effective response. So that's what the National Academy said.
Christopher, let him ask.
Many people have noted that if there are these effects, which have been rather confidently predicted by the National Academy of this country and others, the economic consequences would be extremely substantial. If the coastline receded if the ocean went up and flooded American cities, that would produce some economic impact. Is that not the case?
Yes, which is why, here's what we know. We know that, for example, sea levels rise at a rate of 8 inches per century since the last glaciation just over 10,000 years ago. So sea levels rise at the rate of 8 inches per century. What should we expect? Well, we turn to the UN for this. They have a series of reports called the Fourth Assessment Report was the latest. It's the series of assessment reports. The Fourth Assessment Report, the summary for which came out a month ago, the actual report will be written in 2 months. You work on that one. The summary said that their best guess range for sea level rise for the next century has been cut in half from 6 years ago, when they were also sure, to a range of 7 to 17 inches. As I said, the established consensus record is sea levels rise 8 inches per century, and so we should expect sea level rise either below or slightly above where it's been, but not 20 feet that Al Gore says. And the reason he makes up 20 feet, Eric, is because the truth isn't scary.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment, and I thank you, Eric. Christopher Horner, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. I'm Dennis Prager. All right, for whatever reason, we lost all our calls here and our guest. If you'll take a look there, Sean, I don't know how this happened. Yeah, I know, but I talked to you because you're the man. So we'll have to figure that out. We'll get him back on. Dennis Prager here, Christopher Horner, my guest, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. There must have been some jolt in the phone system, which is too bad because we had a full lineup and really good calls. Call back in, 1-8-PRAGER-776, and we're getting back our guest. That's a very rare, but it happens. It's almost like a lightning sort of thing. And let's see if we do have our guest. He's, again, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide. Christopher Horner, are you there?
I am.
Yeah, we lost you. We lost you and every caller somehow or other at the phone bank. In any event, I want more challenges from callers, but I have to ask you, it's very disturbing Is it fair if a Martian came down or somebody with absolutely no politics came from, let's say, visited from Sri Lanka and were to hear you and me, let's say, and to hear Al Gore and the New York Times editorial page, they would have to say that one is so utterly wrong. How do you, I mean, this is not a subtle difference. This is, he does say that we're talking about 20-foot rise in ocean levels, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And nobody says that. In other words, the man won an Academy Award either for being a prophet or a liar.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I go through, I think, 15 specifics. I think we identified over 100 at CEI.org. You can see Dr. Marla Lewis's dissection of the movie. You're talking about, I'm pointing out what he says, and I'm telling you what's wrong with it. He's not pointing out what anybody else says and saying what's wrong with it. He's making a case. He's making essentially a lawyer's brief, one side, assuming a very gullible jury and no opposing counsel will have an opportunity to speak. He is making things up in some cases, like the 20-foot sea level rise. He is saying flat-out falsehoods in certain cases, like the why Nairobi is where it is and their history with malaria. And he is saying very deceptive things, like with the recreation of the proxy data on concentrations and temperature I just went over. So there are misstatements, there are half-truths, and there are flat-out non-truths. And that is the distinction. It really is that simple. Let me just tell you something. I think you've seen probably that Mr. Gore has canceled long-scheduled interviews with several people from New Zealand to Denmark.
Yeah, I spoke to Bjorn Lomborg in Denmark about that. Yeah.
Right, and Fleming Rose, after Lomborg was exiled from the room and Gore confirmed the interview and a half hour beforehand, said he wouldn't even interview with Fleming Rose. He won't sit down with anyone who could possibly challenge him. When he did, George Stephanopoulos, that pitbull against people like Gore, pointed out that, you know, some people actually have had in the peer-reviewed literature, peer-review is a term that's oversold, we can talk about that, but have pointed out that uncertainties exist, that there is raging debate. If the science is settled here, then there is no such thing as science anymore. Words have no meaning, and the creationism issue is solved, as is stem cell research and everything else. And Gore responded with, they don't know. We just don't know. Or we don't know, we just don't know, about some specifics. After he says the science is settled and nobody disagrees, and then he says we don't know, we just don't know, in fact, regarding the claim of consensus, that's one of his biggest whoppers. He said it on Oprah after the movie. He said it in his PowerPoint presentation before his movie that I saw. He says it in the movie. He says every one of the relevant papers in the scientific literature addressing the topic, he calls it over 928, whatever that means, affirms the theory. Not one paper disagreed. He said not one paper disagreed. And then later in the show and later on Oprah, he repeated the same line. He called that a representative 10% sample, but a pretty good one. Now, one of those statements has to be untrue. They are scripted, because if you watch him, he pulls it in that order every time. And the fact is, if the search he's talking about were done properly, there were over, at the time, 11,000 articles in the relevant peer-reviewed literature. And the person who published this study, a history professor named Naomi Oreskes from your state of California, has had to issue a retraction in Science magazine. And Al Gore knew this, and he continues saying it to this date. So I would suggest that the person from Mars would say, I tell you what, we have two arguments. Let's have a bit of a trial. Let's have that debate that these people keep telling us is over, but nobody can remember ever having.
Very important. All right, well, take your challenges when we come back. I want to talk to you about polar bears, Antarctica ice, Greenland ice, and, as I said, the calls. Also about the change of mind of one of France's greatest scientists. 1-8-PRAGER-776, the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. Christopher Horner, the author, and my guest on The Dennis Prager Show. Anything on your mind about global warming? The man answering your questions is Christopher Horner, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming, up at PragerRadio.com, incidentally. And let's go to your calls. Very important that you express anything that disturbs you on this matter. Northridge, California, Jared. Hi, Jared. Dennis Prager and Christopher Horner.
Hi, nice to meet you guys.
Thank you.
Well, I got a question, Chris. I've heard and read about some articles and studies that scientists are saying that the ice in Greenland is melting, and that's caused by global warming. What do you think about that? Is that true?
Yeah, the ice mass in Greenland is increasing. And so the response has been, well, that's what the models predict in a global warming scenario. There's melt on the western side of Greenland. The ice mass itself is increasing. So when we look at ice masses, we have to decide, do we just look at those that are growing or those are retreating? Because we also hear that retreating glaciers are proof of global warming. Ice mass buildup is proof of global warming. Retreating glaciers are proof of global warming. Drought is proof of global warming. Inundation with rain is proof of rain. In other words, so far we've discovered that everything is proof of this.
Right.
Everything is what is to have been expected. So, yes, the literature does show ice mass buildup as well as melt on the west, and they're both decried as further proof. And that just shows you the wonderful nature of this issue. It's one of these things that is only proven by whatever happens and cannot be disproven.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of weird that we see both buildup and decline, though. So, you know, yeah, definitely.
Well, Jared, pass it along to your generation. It's critical. Thank you. You're so right, Christopher. I was chuckling while you said it because I forgot that fact. Whenever there is any excess rain, I'm told it's global warming, and whenever there is a drought, I'm told there's global warming.
You know, we've told both cases that they were predicted, and therefore we should just accept this fact. It's true they were predicted. The lurid scenarios that we see about the future come from computer models. Computer models are mathematical, they're programs, essentially. And you can model cooling if you wish. They used to when that was fashionable and where the money was, and now they model warming. Willie Sutton would be proud. That's why you rob banks. It's where the money is. Now, we had a report issued just by coincidence in November 2000, the U.S. government's National Assessment on Climate Change, and they used two climate models. They used the wettest and the hottest, temperature and precipitation being the two determinant outputs here. And they, for the Red River Valley, for example, one model predicted it would be a floodplain, and the other predicted severe drought. So in other words, the models tell you something's going to happen, prepare for it. And whatever happens is what was predicted. And that's the beauty of computer models being the basis of public policy.
Excellent. All right, we go to Minneapolis, and Joe. Joe, Christopher Horner, Dennis Prager.
Hey, Dennis, and hey, Christopher. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question and point surround the economics of the issue. I've heard it said many times that global warming, attempting to do things that would reduce our carbon dioxide emissions or sequestering those emissions would cost a lot of money and be a drag on the economy and inhibit economic growth. And I'm looking actually to some extent for some education on this because it seems to me that any of the money that we would spend on these things, it's not like we're going to take it all, put it in a big pile, and light it on fire. If my electric bill goes up $20 a month because my local power company has to capture its carbon and pipe it to a geological formation for it to be sequestered, or you know, my appliances cost more because I have to, or I buy new appliances that are more energy efficient, someone still has to make those appliances and sell them. Someone has to make the equipment that the power companies use. Somebody has to install it. Local farmers here will get lease payments for their land for wind turbines.
All right, excellent. No, excellent. Truly excellent.
You know,
go ahead.
What we're told is that we will be, this is the argument in California, we will become, Silicon Valley will become the Silicon Valley of windmills and energy efficient technologies. The difference between what Silicon Valley was without government mandates and what it would be here is that Silicon Valley wasn't making things that the government made people buy. They were making things that allowed people to become more efficient and create more wealth. Requiring you to use technologies, we're calling them very humorously new technologies that were the technologies that we had before we unleashed the Industrial Revolution and abandoned them for very good reason, so-called renewable technologies. Requiring people to use windmills and solar panels, be it the poor world or the rich world, is not actually going to make us all windmill magnets. What it's going to do is we actually have the laboratories of bureaucracy trying this. It's called Europe. And we know that their carbon dioxide emissions are increasing faster than the U.S., twice as fast since Kyoto was agreed in 1997, and three times as fast since 2000, because this scheme forces investment to go elsewhere. If you had global governance, which is what Jacques Chirac called Kyoto, maybe you could stop what's called carbon leakage, which would be the vast majority of the world that joins the U.S. in rejecting energy rationing in the name of catastrophic man-made global warming. But since the rest of the world says absolutely no, never not going to happen, all you're going to see is what Europe is seeing, which is investment going to China, India, and believe it or not, 175 new jobs at North American Stainless Steel in Kentucky because the parent company, Acerinox, CEO, said, no more growth in Europe. We're all going to America and South Africa because they don't play these games. They have affordable, reliable electricity. We have blackouts, brownouts, and 72% increase in our electricity prices. There's no point investing here. So maybe under global governance, but still you're not going to run the economy on windmills and solar panels until we move out of the hydrocarbon age, which will occur not because we've run out of hydrocarbons any more than, as Bjorn Lomborg says, we left the Stone Age because we ran out of stones.
Okay. Robert in Detroit, you're on with Christopher Horner and Dennis Prager.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I would love to, first of all, go on record that provided the sun comes up tomorrow, that something will happen, so that way I'm safe. I would like to ask, however, if the, is it not a good correlation that the CFC attacks and the successful CFC attacks on fluorocarbons in the 1980s gave them more impetus to expand that into this global warming garbage that doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. If there's a correlation there between their successful ability to change an entire industry.
Okay, an answer?
Right, the answer is the Montreal Protocol had an unintended consequence, which is the substitute chemicals were massively powerful greenhouse gases, 12 times as powerful as CO2, and Europe is paying the Chinese hundreds of millions of dollars every year to create it and destroy it in return for a certificate that represents an indulgence, a supposed emission reduction that never happened.
An indulgence, that's cute. We'll return, final segment coming up, Christopher Horner's book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming, some final thoughts for me and a question or two to my guest. All right, let's get a final thought here from Christopher Horner, his important book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. Give it to friends and ask that your schools provide copies of this, since they're already showing the kids an inconvenient truth. Which reminds me, are schools doing anything to show the other side?
Well, Seattle school districts, as I understood it, were the first to say, well, since we don't have the other side, we better just not show an inconvenient truth. Now, beginning tonight, we know, it's inescapable, that there are presentations of the of cinema variety that may not be, you know, it's difficult to have a compelling 90 minutes of things not melting, but what you can do is interview scientists who apparently don't exist, according to the elites, and listen to what they have to say. And that's what the presentation on the UK's Channel 4 tonight will do. You can watch the trailer. It's a minute long just to give yourself a flavor of it. But then there are people working on getting the rights to have that distributed here. In the meantime, the Independent Institute in California has a video with Sally Balunas, Michael Crichton, and some others discussing the topic. Again, no compelling visuals, simple intellectual discussion and facts.
Sally Balunas is a Harvard astronomer, and Michael Crichton is, of course, the well-known novelist. Go ahead.
Right, a Harvard-trained physician, but he's surrounded by other scientists as well. There's five of them discussing this, George Taylor, the state climatologist for now of Oregon, and others. And they're discussing...
Wait, where will that be?
That's available through the Independent Institute. I think it's independent.org. It's a California group. They sent me a copy. I don't know how to get it out in mass.
Alan, let's get Sally Balunas on. I know her. She's terrific. Okay.
Yeah, so that's a... There are options. There's my book, Marla Lewis Has a Guide, Debunking Al Gore's Movie. There are options if people are interested in pursuing that sincerely. The question is, are they? Because if it's got to be a visually compelling movie, no. Other than the UK Channel 4 program that I'm aware of, there isn't much out there.
Well, we have to have that at least showable on the Internet here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Anyway, congratulations on your book, and thank you for being on my show.
My pleasure, Dennis. Thank you.
You're very welcome. That was Christopher Horner. The book is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. There is another division that I am not certain of, but was just pointed out to me. It's very rare on my show that only one sex calls in. I have more women listeners proportionately than almost any talk show host who has a general show, because I do such a variety of subjects. So it's very rare men and women call in on all hours. But not one woman, to the best of my ability to see to know who's calling in, has called in on this. And I wonder if more women do really believe in the global warming vision of the world, of doomed world, than men do. I don't know. It never occurred to me. The division I had made was liberal-conservative, not male-female, but it is just one I'm throwing out to you, since I throw out all of these ideas all the time. Thank you for listening. I think we will prevail on the global warming issue, because over time, truth wins. This is Dennis Prager. Thanks for listening.